We are talking today with Eric Schwartz and Sarah Weintraub. Eric is with Peace Brigades International and Sarah with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and they have both recently returned from Colombia, and we're going to be talking about that. Eric and Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Start out, and if you would, tell me briefly a little bit about your organizations. Maybe, Eric, start with you.
I work with Peace Brigades International. I just finished 1 year in Bogota, the capital of Colombia. Peace Brigades International has projects in Colombia, Mexico, Guatemala, and Indonesia. We've been in Colombia for 10 years. And we do a work called accompaniment, which means that we're a physical presence with people who have risks because of the human rights work that they do. So a lawyer who might get threats because he's bringing charges against a military official, or a women's group that might get threats for challenging social control of the paramilitaries of one of the armed groups. We go around with them. We're a presence next to them so that people who might want to hurt them see us and decide not to attack them and not to threaten them. And it's a way to not just save individual lives, but to open a space for really important human rights work that wouldn't be able to be done otherwise, and hopefully have a multiplier effect in that way on the conflict as a whole to help support initiatives, Colombian initiatives for peace and justice.
And Sarah?
Fellowship of Reconciliation is a very old pacifist organization founded around 1915 at the start of the First World War. It's an interfaith organization, and I work for the United States Fellowship of Reconciliation. There are also affiliates in 40 other countries that do similar pacifist work, but each one works independently. And the United States Fellowship of Reconciliation has many projects in peacemaking and conflict resolution, and they also have a task force on Latin America and the Caribbean, which is the branch that I work for. And among the projects of that task force is the Colombia Peace Presence. And our project in Colombia is also focused on accompaniment, although we also do other things. We provide accompaniment in this pretty similar way to what Eric was talking about to a community in northwestern Colombia, which is a peace community. That is a community that is located in a very strategic location that both the guerrilla groups and the paramilitary and the military all want control of this region and expect cooperation from the civilian population. So the peace communities, of which there are many, have decided that they don't want to participate in the war and they want to fight in a nonviolent way for their rights as civilians in a conflict zone, their rights under international humanitarian law. So we also provide them accompaniment in the same way to open up a little bit of space for this really incredible and inspiring initiative that's already taking place there in Colombia. And we also have another aspect of our project. I think Peace Brigades is mostly accompaniment, if not completely accompaniment, whereas FOR, we do other things also. We think of our mandate as both the accompaniment aspect and also the education of our own people. So that includes dissemination of information about the peace communities and other peace initiatives through many different ways. We host speaking tours where we bring Colombians to the United States to talk about the work that they're doing in human rights. We also bring humanitarian delegations to Colombia, which are groups of 10 to 15 people who go and visit the initiatives and learn about it and then come back and educate their communities. We also have a traveling photo exhibit about the peace communities and many other projects, which we think of as ways to make visible the peace initiatives that are going on in Colombia, which is something that we really don't hear about at all in the mainstream U.S. media. And through making them visible, we raise their profile and therefore help give them a little space for protection also.
Could you give us a brief history of the situation in Colombia and why you chose to personally go there?
Sure. I always like to start these explanations, and my Colombian friends insist that I start these explanations by saying that Colombia is a really beautiful country. And sometimes we forget that when we talk about the conflict and the violence. The Andes go up the middle of Colombia. There's jungle off to the west. There's huge, really hot plains where cattle raising goes on the east of the country. And so it's an amazing country. Unfortunately, it's a country that's suffered from a civil war for the past 40 years. That pits, on the one hand, left-wing guerrilla groups, Marxist guerrilla groups, and on the other hand, the Colombian army. Since 1980, new groups called paramilitaries have been created that, according to Amnesty International reports, act basically as death squads for the Colombian army. A lot of different sources have shown, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the United Nations, that the paramilitaries and the military work very closely together. Sometimes it's a little confusing, guerrillas, paramilitaries. They're both illegal armies, but the guerrilla attacks the government, and the paramilitary groups defend the government and cooperate, according to Amnesty International, with the military. And unfortunately, most of the people who die in Colombia's conflict, which comes out to 15 people a day, are civilians. And they're not people who are just caught in the crossfire. Like, I think sometimes we think that people die in other countries just because they're violent there and they just get kind of crazy and start shooting each other. But there's really a logic, I think, to why these people who we accompany are targeted. And they're targeted as civilians because of the civilian work that they're doing. So, for example, lawyers are threatened or killed because they bring charges against high-ranking military officials for their participation in massacres. Women's groups are targeted because they challenge paramilitary social control in communities and they empower communities. And peace communities are targeted because they challenge control of important economic interests and also because they're reclaiming their autonomy. And victims groups who accompany are targeted and have been killed many, many times because they're demanding justice for all of their victims of past human rights abuses. And so the reason I wanted to be a volunteer with PBI is that I think it's really exciting to support local initiatives in a way that still really respects their independence and their autonomy. Like, we're there as a support for them to provide a really minimum guarantee, which is to their life and hopefully to be able to do their work without the stress of threats and harassment and being followed, so that those local initiatives can do what they know how to do best, which is work for peace and justice in Colombia.
How did you choose, Sarah, to get involved in this work?
Well, similar to Eric, I was really attracted to the non-intervention aspect of accompaniment work, that we're not coming in from the outside saying, here's how you should do things better there, or coming in as experts. I think the attitude of an accompanier is really one of humility, that we kind of come in to use our privilege in a global power sense of our privilege of being from these Western countries that have influence over the Colombian government, and we use that privilege that we have in order to make a little bit more space for these initiatives that are going on, and that we come in to learn from them, really, that they are the ones who know what they're doing and who are providing this amazing example of peaceful resistance in a war zone, in a war country. And I think we from Western countries have a lot to learn from that. And also we can use those kind of global power dynamics to support that at the same time. So to me, that's really exciting. And I was really interested in accompaniment. I was living in Central America and had heard about the accompaniment that was going on there more during the 80s, although there's still projects there now. Yeah, so that was how I got involved. And the more I learned about the way it worked and the project and the peace community, the more excited I got and the more I wanted to work there.
So maybe you can share with us some of your initial experiences when you got there. Was it what you expected when you arrived?
Well, for me, I had been really working on trying not to have many expectations and just to be ready for whatever came. So I'm not sure if it was exactly what I expected or not, but where I was living was very rural. In order to get to the settlement, which I lived in, which is one of the three settlements of the peace community, you fly into a kind of regional airport, a very small regional airport, and then from there take what's called a chivero, which is like a little jeep that they pack with about 25 people on top and hanging off the sides and everything. So you take one of these over a very rough road to the main town of the region, which just has two little streets. And then from there, you either walk or ride a mule or a horse up about an hour and a half through just incredible green jungle to the settlement where I was living, which was, there were about 120 people lived there. So it was very isolated. And I wasn't surprised. I knew it was going to be that way, but that it was a definite change for me. But one experience that I had right at the beginning of my stay, which really enforced my ideas of what accompaniment is and its importance, we had been living in the town for about 3 weeks. We had just arrived, and then we had to leave. There were some meetings and workshops in Bogota that we had to go to as a team. And when we came back, I ended up going up first. I was in a team of three, and my two partners stayed in a different settlement, and I went up to where we had been living by myself, or with peace community members, but by myself as FOR. And it had been a long day of journeying, and I was really exhausted, and I was riding a horse. I practically fell asleep. I mean, it was just, and I was hungry, and I was just thinking, I'm just going to get up to my little house. You know, we had our little accompaniment house, and make something to eat that's quick and go to sleep because I'm totally exhausted. And when I got there, people were so happy to see me. It was like all these people gathered around me and welcome, and we're so glad you're back, and we feel so much better, and thank you so much, and how was your trip, and here, have some coffee, and come over to my house, and my wife will give you dinner, and just, I mean, on and on. And I really felt I had arrived completely depleted of energy, and I just felt infused with energy from how glad the people were to have me there. So that was really thrilling, kind of, that it was so needed and so appreciated. The FOR project started from an invitation from the community. They requested, please come and live with us and accompany us. And that was how the project started. And it still very much has that feeling that they really want us there. And people were saying to me, oh, things are just so much different when you're here. I feel so much safer when you're back. So that was really exciting. That was right at the beginning when I arrived.
How big of a community was that?
The community, the settlement that I lived in, is 120 people, and it's part of a peace community that has three settlements of different sizes, and they say around 1,000 campesinos, 1,000 peasants live in the community. I think it's not quite that many, but with so much displacement and people moving and leaving and moving to other settlements, I think it's hard to keep track of how many members there are, but I know in the settlement I lived in, there was about 120, including children.
And when did you kind of deal with your first conflict or crisis?
Do you want to answer any question while I think about it?
sure. So I was mostly just a bureaucrat in capital, I gotta admit, but not always. And I think maybe I'll sacrifice my dignity to show how normal our jobs are, to hopefully encourage other people to do it, and how everyone has misconceptions. So when I got to Bogota, the capital, which is a beautiful city and a very, very modern city, I gotta admit, I was terrified the first time I accompanied. I was thinking, like, oh my God, the paramilitaries are going to, like, shoot this guy's car at any moment. It was a lawyer we were accompanying who was working on a really high-profile case. And I was looking around and everything. But it's really generally not like that. And I was wrong. We're not, like, human shields exactly. The idea, I think, in both of our work is that it should be preventative, that the people who are maybe watching, the people we accompany, the human rights workers, see us there and know that there's going to be a big stink for the Colombian government if anything happens to those people. And we reinforce that by always meeting with the government and meeting with military officials. But my first experience, I think, maybe outside of that and seeing a little more closely the conflict is when I went on a trip with a group called Asfades. Asfades is family members of disappeared people, kind of like the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo. And disappearance doesn't mean that someone went out for a coffee and got lost. It's a political crime, usually by military or paramilitary groups, in which a person is kidnapped and then killed, but their body is hidden or is thrown into a river. And so it's a double crime. It's a crime of murder, but it's also a crime against the family, because the family is never able to grieve and is never able to know for sure what happened to their loved one and how their loved one died. And so I went on a trip to a town called Monteria, which is really a paramilitary stronghold. It's where the negotiations with the paramilitaries are going on right now. And we accompanied Asfades. We accompanied a man named Jose Daniel. His father and uncle died in a paramilitary massacre several years ago, in which 43 people were kidnapped, tortured for several days, and then killed. And some of the bodies were disappeared, thrown in the river. Others were buried in the back of the municipal cemetery in this town, in an unmarked mass grave. And so the people from Asfades, went to the grave for an exhumation by the government, because in order to press more charges against more of the paramilitary and military officials who they said were responsible, they had to find the bodies. And plus, Jose Daniel really wanted to find his father's and uncle's body in order to to grieve and to put an end to years of not knowing what had happened to them. And so they asked for PBI to accompany them as a way for safety, basically, in order to discourage paramilitaries from doing anything to them in an area that was so controlled by the paramilitaries. And so I saw that it was really important, I think, our presence for allowing their work to go forward and to hopefully find justice in the Colombian courts for what had been done to his family members and the other 41 people. And I also saw, I think, the effect that the conflict has on people, even if they don't, you know, even if the people we accompany are no longer killed, they still receive threats sometimes. And I think I saw how debilitating the fear can be for them. People we accompany sometimes are very afraid, and I'm sure Sarah can talk about this too, and it's not normal. Like, I think sometimes in the U.S. we think that, of course, there's violence there. They must be used to it. It's just a crazy, violent country. But for these people, it's really not normal, and it's not normal to have people call their house and threaten their children, and it has, you know, it affects their health, it affects the way they sleep, it affects the general way they feel, and it's not something that they accept, and it's not something that I think anyone should accept as normal or inevitable.
I was thinking about your question about crises or facing crises, and I think there were various crises that came up, whether of a political nature, of a conflict nature. I mean, one thing that I've been telling everyone since I've gotten home, I just got home 2 weeks ago, and all my parents' friends and everybody say, oh, I'm so glad you're home safe. And I'm kind of like, well, as if I were in danger this whole time. And I really didn't feel like I was. Throughout the year I was living there, I didn't feel like I was in danger for my personal safety. And I think that I did know what was going on. I mean, I was living in the community and also keeping aware of the national situation. And it wasn't that I was there naively, and that's why I didn't know that I was in danger. I think I really wasn't as an international humanitarian worker. So one of my friends said to me the other day, well, you know much more about Colombia than I do. So if you say you were safe, then I'll believe you. I'll trust you. And I was like, wow, thanks. But anyway, so I wanted to say the major way that I came in contact with the armed groups was at a military checkpoint, that the military had a pretty permanent checkpoint between one of the settlements of the peace community, the larger town settlement, and the nearest town, which was the nearest city, I guess, which is where you had to go to buy groceries or anything else. And they pretty much always had a checkpoint on that road. That was the dirt road that you ride the chivero on. Yeah, that was pretty regular, and it varied. Sometimes they'd take everybody off almost always take everybody off of the car, and then sometimes ask for IDs, sometimes look at people's fingerprints, sometimes ask questions, pat the men down. It kind of varied what they did. And other times they would just kind of look in people's bags, and then everybody would get back on. But one thing that I noticed after I went through that checkpoint many, many, many times, because we went to Apartado, which is that city, at least once a week, if not more. And at first, I would kind of get scared and nervous. You know, I mean, they're men with big guns. That's kind of scary, I think, in any situation. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, something in my attitude changed, and maybe as I was learning more about how the conflict works, and I kind of started seeing those soldiers not as these sort of examples of evil or something along that lines, but really they're young. And they're poor, and this is what they have to do. In Colombia, there's a draft where all men are required to serve, I think, a year or a year and a half in either the military or the police. They're required to serve that. After that service, they get a little book that says that they served, and then they need that book in order to get a job or go to university. So if they're campesinos, if they're just going to be working in the countryside, they don't have to serve because they don't need that book. But anybody who wants to do anything else or who lives in a city is forced to serve. You can also buy the book if you have enough money. So I think that means that the soldiers are really from the lower classes. I mean, similar to soldiers in our own country. So that was a change for me when I started going through that checkpoint. I think also, I mean, it was often the same soldiers. We started recognizing each other. It kind of became a different event after a while. But the other thing I wanted to say was just talk a little bit about a typical day that I had in accompaniment. Well, there weren't really typical days, but to just give a sense of the kind of activities that I did, because it wasn't all the time, I mean, very, very slight amounts of the time. It wasn't at all, oh my God, they're coming in, what do we do? I mean, that happened like twice maybe, and then they didn't actually come in. Or I mean, it wasn't like there was a constant presence of armed groups or constant attacks by armed groups by any means. I think what there was is, like what Eric was saying, constant fear of that. And I really saw that living with this community. I mean, it wasn't like we lived somewhere else and visited them and talked to them. It was like we really lived there, and we were there during the night, and we were there during the day. And talk to people in many, many situations. So I think through that, I really saw what it is, that it's a traumatized community, that they've suffered enormous amounts of violence and are really scared. And I think that's another purpose of accompaniment. I mean, there's the actual effectiveness of dissuading the armed groups from attacking, but there's also the encouragement factor of, like I was telling that story about when I came home that day and people were so happy and relieved, and that just makes them feel more relaxed and able to keep doing the work that they're doing. So yeah, instead of responding to desperate crises every day, what I ended up doing most of the time was I was around town a lot, hanging out with people, visiting people. It's, as I was saying, a very rural town, and we accompanied work groups. The community is divided into work groups. Instead of going out individually, they usually go out in a group, both for their own protection, and also it's one of the organizational structures within the community and to strengthen their community. So we would accompany the work groups out to their fields where they were growing bananas or beans or whatever was going on there, and be there during the day while they worked for their protection. So that was one aspect of the work. And another thing we did was accompany the community leaders down to town where they had to pass through that military checkpoint. And then they had to be in the town of Apartado, which is a pretty paramilitarized city. So we went with them if they had to go to a meeting or even a doctor's appointment. So we did that also. And then there was a lot of hanging out in town and visiting people and chatting and eating. And that kind of stuff was a big part of it, which was important, you know, for getting to know people and learning their stories and kind of staying abreast of the situation and the rumors and all that. And also is a really enjoyable way to spend time with people. So,
you've both mentioned interactions with the Colombian government and with the military. And there's a lot of players, in a way, in Colombia, the government and the military being two big ones. There's also, as you've mentioned, the paramilitaries. Did you have interactions with any of the paramilitary there?
Yeah, well, in the region that I was living in, the region that I was based in, the paramilitary at this point they're not a troop. They're not like a group of people that go from place to place committing massacres or whatever. In the specific region that I was living in, I'm talking about a really tiny place because they are nearby in troop form, and they used to be. Where I was living. But at this point, what people talk about is that they say the structures are paramilitarized. People use like paramilitarized rather than paramilitary. So there are paramilitaries, but they're not out in the mountains wearing camouflage. It's more that they're living in the city and they're influencing somebody in the government, or there's that kind of relationship more. So I saw people who, community members who knew, would point out and say, oh, that's a paramilitary, that's so-and-so the paramilitary. But I wouldn't have known that otherwise. My only interaction with paramilitaries who I would have known were paramilitaries was when I was taking a bus from Apartado to Medellin, which is the main city of the state that I was living in. And at a certain point, there's a paramilitary checkpoint, and they don't check IDs, they don't check bags, they don't do anything. They just charge 10,000 pesos per car, which is about $4. So the car that I was in a bus, and the bus paid the 10,000 pesos, and we went on our way. And that's all. It's just their like toll. They're like charging a toll. So in terms of paramilitaries, yeah, that was my interaction with them.
Like Sarah said, I probably saw paramilitaries who are part of the AUC paramilitary structure dressed as civilians, for example, when I went to accompany that exhumation of the mass grave. I never saw myself paramilitaries in uniform.
And yet my understanding is that they're one of the major forces there in terms of terror and targeting civilians. So would you just then see the end results of their work?
I think it really varies where you're living. I mean, I think in the peace community where I was living, at this point, there isn't a paramilitary presence, although there's fear that they could come in at any moment. But in other communities and other peace communities right nearby, I mean, right in that same region, there are paramilitary camps that, you know, they station themselves there, or they come in, and they're much more upfront about it. So I think where I was living, it was more like you heard about things that the paramilitaries had done rather than actually seeing them, but that there are still many places in Colombia where the people see them come in with their armbands, you know, identifying themselves as paramilitaries.
So I think in some places where PBI accompanies, the paramilitary control has reached the stage that Sarah is talking about of co-opting, infiltrating government institutions, co-opting social organizations, and trying to control all aspects of daily life. In some places, for example, they impose different kinds of social norms, like women can't wear short skirts, and if they do, they have to go and or women who gossip have to publicly sweep the town square. But in other parts of Colombia, the old traditional classic paramilitary tactics are very much in play, and I can maybe talk about one experience that I had. Again, according to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, the majority, the large majority of human rights abuses and violations of the Geneva Accords in Colombia are committed by the paramilitaries, and also according to Amnesty International, many, many times, those abuses happen with full knowledge and in some cases cooperation from the military, the regular Colombian army. And so I recently accompanied a human rights organization from Bogota, which went with a commission of many groups to investigate the human rights situation for children in a tiny little corner of Colombia called Arauca, which is beautiful. It's cattle country. It's right near Venezuela. It's very hot. And one of the things they were investigating was a massacre committed by paramilitaries very recently in May. And so I met the people we were accompanying in the airport in Bogota, and we flew out to this region. And then we all got piled into a truck and drove across the plains. And as we went, we saw the highway was very, very militarized. There was two, four, six Colombian soldiers like every 500 meters in some places. We also passed a military base, a large military base on the highway, and as we left the town where the base was in, where the military had a checkpoint set up, which is a permanent checkpoint. And then we got to the town where the massacre happened. And so what the commission was told and what appears in the commission's report is that in May, a group of paramilitaries went out to the highway, set up a permanent checkpoint, stopping cars for 4 hours. They gathered up 100 cars over these 4 hours, and so one would think that the military base half an hour away would have realized that no cars were coming from this direction. They either didn't realize, or according to the commission, they realized but didn't act. According to the commission, after holding people at the checkpoint, the paramilitaries then kidnapped four people, including two teenagers, and took them off on a minor road where they initiated basically a killing rampage for 36 hours, without the army doing anything to stop it. They went along this road kidnapping people and killing people. Sometimes they tortured them before they killed them. They burned their arms and legs, according to the commission's report, and most of them were killed by taking their heads off, which is a horrible way to kill someone. And 11 people were killed over a day and a half time, and so I think that both of those, Arauca is one corner of the country where the old traditional tactics of paramilitary violence and terror are still very much in play.
Then one of the other main players is the FARC, the rebel forces. Can you tell us about them and if you had any dealings or heard about experiences with them?
Well, the FARC started in 1964 as a Marxist-based agrarian reform peasant army, basically. Originally, the idea was about addressing social inequalities and the fact that in Colombia, as in Latin America in general, the small elite oligarchy controlled everything and the peasants were close to being slaves. So that was the start of this group. But as the years have gone on and there's been a huge influx of drug money and other factors, I'd say the FARC and the guerrilla groups in Colombia in general have really lost their ideological north. I think it's pretty widely acknowledged that there's not much feeling that they're fighting for the people at all anymore. One major thing that happened was there was a demilitarization process at a certain point in the 80s when the FARC were in negotiations and they ended up creating a political party, which is the Patriotic Union was the name of the political party. Mm-hmm. And other people got involved in that political party also, not just people from the FARC, but other people who wanted to work for social mm-hmm. change. And the Patriotic Union was basically, there was basically a genocide of the Patriotic Union. Pretty much all the candidates and even people were just members of the party or had maybe voted for the party once. I mean, they were just wiped out. And so
over 3,000 people were killed in the space of about 8 years, including two presidential candidates and one senator.
Right, right. Thank you. And so I think at that point what happened is all the kind of politically minded, socially committed members of the FARC went over to the Patriotic Union and were basically wiped out. And so who was left in the FARC? It was pretty much the military-minded, the war-making side of the organization. So I think the FARC was already losing itself or losing whatever ideals it might have had, and that made it much, much worse. I see that as one of the major factors. And at this point, it really varies around the country. I mean, the FARC is a huge force and is present in many different parts of the country, and there may be some part of the country where civilians feel like the FARC is fighting for them. That certainly wasn't the case where I was living. There wasn't any feeling that they're on our side or they're our army at all. People were really afraid of the guerrilla. Not as afraid of the guerrilla as of the paramilitaries, because the paramilitaries have committed a lot more massacres and other horrible abuses. But there wasn't any identification with or sympathy towards the guerrilla. One thing is that Colombia has the highest kidnapping rate in the world. I think 50% of the world's kidnappings take place in Colombia, and most of those are done by the FARC and by other illegal groups also, but mostly by the FARC. And they kidnap mostly wealthy as well as upper middle class as well as middle class Colombians, and much of it, sometimes they kidnap Colombians and also foreigners for political reasons, but often it's just for money. Often it's just for the ransom money. That's one of their major sources of income, the other being the drug trafficking. So, and in terms of my interactions with them or that side of things, the region I was living in, which is the region of Urabá, which includes parts of three states and has the border to Panama as well as the Gulf of Urabá, which opens out onto the Caribbean there in the northwestern corner. And it's a region that originally was kind of was won over by campesinos, kind of, you know, like the Wild West or something. I mean, they went in there and basically cut down the jungle and planted crops, and there wasn't much government presence there. And when the FARC grew, they took control of that area. I mean, they kind of just used it as their space and walked through and did whatever. And then in really like the 80s and 90s, the paramilitaries started trying to win that area over. The paramilitary strongholds really was right next door, right in the state next door, and they wanted that strategic area both for the waterways through the Darién to Panama as well as to the Caribbean. So that was when the conflict started really strongly in that region, as the paramilitary started winning over that area. And at this point, most people will say that the guerrillas still have control in the high mountains and the paramilitaries have control in the cities. The major cities there, they're called the Eje Bananero. It's the four kind of banana-growing hub cities. It's a banana region. And those are under paramilitary control. And yet everyone admits that the FARC is still there in the mountains. And there are high mountains there. I mean, they can be in the mountains and be pretty far away. And the peace community where I was living is really kind of right in the foothills of the mountains. So as you can imagine, it's right between those two zones of control. And for that reason, it's very strategic for both groups and very contested. So living in that region, I did see the guerrilla. They did go by. It wasn't a problem at any point. But the guerrilla and the military both have a lot of presence in that region, both trying to win it over and both using it as their highway and walking through there. So I did see both of them.
Eric, did you have any experience with the FARC?
No, I never saw either group. And from the mandate of our organization, unless we're in a checkpoint and we're forced to, we don't talk to either paramilitaries or guerrilla groups.
Yeah, we don't either.
So the other big player in all of this is the U.S. In terms of military support, I believe Colombia is the second largest recipient of U.S. third largest recipient of U.S. military arms, as well as there's U.S. private contractors down there. Can you talk about what you've seen of that and the effects of those two groups?
Well, Colombia is the third largest recipient of U.S. money in general. That is, after Israel and Egypt, Colombia gets the next largest amount of money, which I think is really hidden. I don't think anybody would guess Colombia if you asked who gets the most money from the U.S., the third largest amount of money. So that's in pretty incredible amount of money that goes to Colombia, and just a little bit about why it would go to Colombia, and then I think you had stuff to say about interactions. Yeah. Colombia is an incredibly strategic country. It's right at the mouth to South America. It has borders with Panama, and then with Venezuela, Brazil, Peru, and Ecuador. So it really kind of touches many countries. It also has a Pacific coast and a Caribbean coast. So in that way, it's a kind of geographically very strategic location. The other thing that Colombia has going for it, and a reason that the U.S. would want to be involved, is that it's an oil-rich country, as well as being right next door to Venezuela, which is a very oil-rich country, and what is it, the fifth largest? More oil comes from Venezuela to the U.S. than any other country in this hemisphere. Colombia is very rich in other things. It's a very fertile land. There's a lot of bananas, coffee, cocoa beans, as well as, of course, coca, which is one of the ingredients of cocaine. So for that reason, the U.S. has been very interested in Colombia for a long time. And at this point, there's a lot of aid that goes to Colombia, both in the form of what they call counter-narcotics aid and also counter-terrorism aid, which are both different forms of military aid. And there's also other humanitarian aid to Colombia, but the military aid is about 80%. The figures vary on that, but about 80% comes in the form of either counter-narcotics or counter-terrorism. And that was a change since September 11th. Before that time, the aid that went to Colombia had to be used for counter-narcotics. And after that time, the two major guerrilla groups in Colombia, as well as the paramilitaries, were named as foreign terrorist organizations. And the aid was opened up to work on counter-terrorism, which in this context has really meant counter-insurgency. So that's where the aid is going for the most part.
Yeah, I agree with everything that Sarah just said, and also Colombia is really rich in fresh water, which could be important for the future. I think it has the biggest supply of fresh water in all of South America, and also biodiversity. Going back to the oil question, Venezuela is its fifth biggest supplier of oil to the U.S., and Colombia is the seventh biggest supplier. And also beyond the general interests of keeping access to that oil, there's also a few U.S. companies that operate in Colombia. For example, Occidental Petroleum, based in Los Angeles, owns one of the largest oil wells in Colombia in the very region that I just mentioned, in Arauca, near Venezuela. Arauca has traditionally had a lot of presence of the guerrilla groups, which bomb the pipeline, which does a lot of environmental damage, and it also, of course, damages the profitability of the pipeline for Occidental. Even, I think, more threatening to Occidental, there's been a lot of civilian and peaceful resistance to the effects of the oil pipeline. For example, there's an indigenous group called the UWA that organized with a lot of international support, and that, according to them, that their campaign is why Occidental decided not to expand their drilling in the region. And so, beyond the $2.4 billion that the U.S. has given to Colombia since 2000, on top of that, last year, the U.S. gave $98 million to create a battalion in Arauca, in this region, with the sole purpose of protecting the oil pipeline. And beyond that, there's other kinds of training and equipment that goes to the Colombian military in Arauca and has been for several years. According to Amnesty International's recent report about Arauca, there's at least 60 U.S. Green Berets in Arauca. In the country as a whole, 400 U.S. troops is the cap allowed by law, and 400 contractors. And so I had a really interesting experience. When I was in Arauca, just getting ready to leave after this commission, I was in the airport, you know, it's a tiny little regional airport, and there was this guy with jeans and kind of dirty sneakers and a t-shirt and a big gun. I gotta tell you, I'm used to seeing big guns in Colombia, but usually the people who have them have camouflage and could identify with their name and rank. But this guy didn't, and he was kind of patrolling, and then he went over and talked to some other guys with big guns who did have camouflage, and they had their names, but they didn't have any kind of identification of what force they were from. And so there's two of those guys. I don't know if they're from U.S. Army or contractors, but they were definitely Americans. You know, I heard them talk, and that's a unmistakable accent. So if we can imagine foreign troops patrolling without any identification in our airports, I think we can see how what that might be like.
So I'm getting the impression that with half the world's kidnappings happening in Colombia, the bulk of the people who, civilians who are being killed in this conflict, are being targeted for their work in trying to bring about a better and more just society there. You've got the paramilitaries who are aligned with the government, who don't seem concerned about the well-being of the people, or in fact doing a lot of the targeting. You've got the FARC, who supposedly, according to our corporate media, are the enemy there, who don't seem concerned about the people who are doing terrorizing. Then you've got the U.S. funding military advisors and contractors down there who don't seem concerned about the people. It does sound like just a complete country that's living in terror, and no one, with the exception of perhaps groups like yours, seems concerned with the civilians, the citizens of that country. Am I getting that correct?
Yeah, I think, I mean, to a certain extent, all that, with all those, what you were saying, all those different groups who aren't concerned about the well-being of the people, I think that's really accurate. I think, though, there's a plethora, a myriad of Colombian organizations that are working for human rights and for peace in different ways. I mean, so many. There are the ones that we accompany. PBI accompanies a lot of human rights defenders, lawyers, and others. We are focused right now on the peace community, but there are many, many others. There's a group in Medellin, for example, called Red Juvenil, which means kind of youth network, and they do direct action protests as well as conscientious objectorship. They also do team building and non-competitive games in the schools. I mean, they do a whole lot of things. There's another group, I'm just naming ones that I'm familiar with, that I know the people. There's a group called Luz de Luna, which means moonlight, which is a street theater group in Bogota, and they do street theater in their neighborhoods. They're from the poor neighborhoods, and they do street theater right there where it's all happening, about disappearance and about also social inequality between men and women and many other topics. There's a women's group called Ruta Pacifica, which means the peaceful way. And they do, one of their main projects is these huge caravans to parts of the country that are abandoned, so to speak. Like, their last one, I think, was to Putumayo, which is in the south of the country, where a lot of the aerial fumigation of coca plants is going on, which is creating just enormous human tragedy and people being fumigated, their food crops being fumigated. And this women's group does a caravan of thousands of women where they all go together down to Putumayo and are there in solidarity with their sisters, you know? So I think while in some ways the situation in Colombia is very bleak, there are all these little lights of peaceful initiatives and Colombian peaceful initiatives. There are international groups that are working there supporting them, but it's really coming from the Colombian people, which is really inspiring. And so that's another aspect of the civilian population is really present and in a very creative and diverse way working for peace within their own country and want peace. And they're not just throwing up their hands and saying, this is crazy, how can I get to Miami? They're really engaged, and all different class levels. Poor people and rich people are engaged in peace efforts, whether separately or together. There's a lot going on there.
So if you two were in charge of the U.S. State Department, what changes would you be implementing?
Well, in general, I think the military aid to Colombia, to both the Colombian police force and military, has served the purpose of further militarizing the conflict and really escalating the conflict. That what you have is a situation where the Colombian military has pretty much unlimited resources. I mean, in terms of that, those millions and billions from the U.S., as well as a pretty unlimited supply of soldiers from the draft that they have going on. And the FARC, on the other side, also have pretty unlimited resources from kidnapping and drug trafficking, and also a pretty unlimited supply of soldiers from, or of fighters, from the huge amounts, the huge number of people who are displaced and who have really no other option. A lot of people end up either with the FARC or with the paras or with the military because their displacement is like becoming a refugee in your own country. So anyway, I think that there is not a military solution to the conflict. And aiming for a military solution is just making the conflict worse and worse and worse and really creating more and more and more civilian tragedies. And what the Colombian groups call for is a negotiated solution to the conflict, that the government and the FARC and the paras need to sit down and you know, work things out and negotiate. And at this point, there's not much possibility for that, for a genuine negotiation, because there's no trust. The last time the FARC negotiated was when there was really that genocide of the Patriotic Union. Well, that's not the last time they negotiated, but that was one of the times they negotiated. The last time they negotiated, I think both sides were negotiating, and this was under the previous president in 2000 and around there, and they were both negotiating not in good faith, but as part of their military strategy. So I would support that, support what the Colombian groups are asking for, which is a negotiated solution. And that starts with trust building and getting uninterested outsiders to come in and mediate that, whether that's the UN or whoever else. So in terms of what the State Department should do, I think I'm not a policy expert. That wasn't what I studied, and I was doing a different kind of work, but in some way support that negotiation rather than support the further militarization. And the Colombian government, the president and the vice president, talk about the militarization. They say that they're not trying to win by military means, but they're trying to force the FARC to negotiate by making them weak. But from what I've seen, the FARC are not really getting weaker. They may be transforming and becoming more of a traditional guerrilla army, which is up in the mountains, rather than a sort of a different kind of force that they were for many years, where they really owned huge swaths of Colombia. But they don't seem any nearer to going away or negotiating through the current policies and strategies.
Yeah, PBI doesn't have a position on U.S. foreign policy or U.S. aid to Colombia, but I would say that a lot of the groups that we accompany say exactly what Sarah is saying about the importance of a negotiated political solution with the two guerrilla groups, the FARC and the ELN. And a lot of the groups that we accompany also say that in order to do that, there also needs to be a real demobilization of the paramilitary groups. And so right now, there's a negotiation process going on, not with the FARC or the ELN, the guerrilla groups, but with the right-wing paramilitaries. And so a lot of the groups that we accompany, like the family members of disappeared people, or a son of a Patriotic Union senator who was killed, we accompany, have been very active in criticizing that process, because they say that if the group that's negotiating and giving forgiveness and deciding who's responsible and how much jail time they need to do is the government, and yet the government was in some way responsible for the creation and formation and many of the crimes of the paramilitaries, then it's really hard to expect that there's going to be any kind of real justice for the higher-up people who are responsible for those crimes. And also the proposals that have come out so far don't, according to the groups that we accompany, don't seem to address their demands, which are for a real justice, that the real people responsible brought to justice, real repatriations for all of Colombia's victims, the people who've been forced off their land, family members of people who've been killed or disappeared, and truth, and to really, like in the South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, to know exactly who was responsible at all levels. And there was one negotiation process so far, which according to the International Crisis Group and Amnesty International, they demobilized 800 people, but even the government recently admitted that many of them were just common criminals who just jumped on board the negotiation process. The 800 people only turned in something like 600 weapons, and according to the International Crisis Group, the paramilitaries, in an unarmed way, continued to exercise control in the neighborhoods of Medellin where they were active before. And so a real demobilization process, according to Azbades, for example, would look very different.
Yeah, one of the things I don't hear of you mentioning in the negotiations is the Colombian groups you're working with. It seems to me they should be key players in any negotiations.
But yeah, there hasn't been much involvement from the peace and human rights groups, although there has been some, and there. The peace and human rights groups are very diverse, and there are some who say, you know, any paramilitary who turns in his weapon is one less paramilitary who's going to be killing us, and so great, if that's the best we're going to get, then great. And there have been groups who have supported the negotiations. Most of them don't. Most of them feel like it's a kind of a loophole for the government to create impunity, really, to create a way for maybe punish a few scapegoats, but basically let these people go. But it varies. But in terms of being present at the negotiations, that hasn't, the peace and human rights groups haven't been. There's such a variety and a diversity. There are some groups that are kind of human rights NGOs, but that really belong to the government, and yet they're called NGOs, and those ones have been more present. There are certain NGOs that work on anti-kidnapping, for example, that not all of them, but some of them tend to be really part of the government. So it varies.
All right. We are just about out of time. How can people find out more about your groups? How can they get involved? What levels can they get involved at?
Well, to find out more about our project, the best source is the website, which is www.forusa.org. And from there, there are links to the Columbia Peace Presence. And there are a lot of ways to get involved in what we're doing. For example, I mentioned earlier that we have delegations, people who go down to Columbia and really see it firsthand. Those are open. Also, hosting speaking tours, hosting the photo exhibit. There's also being on our urgent action list and being on our Columbia update list. Our Columbia update list is a way to stay involved, and it'll let you know what's going on, and it includes a letter from the field from the people who are living there, as well as other information about what's going on in Columbia to stay informed. And the urgent action list is a way that we activate our grassroots contacts in an emergency, and those come out as, please call your congressman and tell them whatever it might be, tell them to tell Uribe, who's the president of Colombia, not to threaten the international groups or whatever it might be. And then that chain of command goes from the congressman to the U.S. embassy to Uribe, we hope. And that's been very effective in the past. And so that's really important to have committed people on that list. There are a lot of ways to get involved. So I think the best thing is to please go to that website and check it out and see how you're interested in participating. We also accept donations, and we also need them. We're in a period of fundraising right now as we're looking to launch a new office in our project. We right now have an office in La Union, which is the settlement of the peace community where we live, and we're looking to have presence both in the peace community and also in the capital to be able to do our political work more effectively and to also learn about the other peace initiatives and look at other ways to support them. So we're in the process right now of planning for and visioning and fundraising for our Bogota office, which we're hoping to open in January, and I will be one of the staff members in that office. So donations are more than welcome.
So for Peace Brigades, Peace Brigades International, you can look at our website, peacebrigades.org, and I think it's really important to have American volunteers. We're mostly Europeans, but it's really important to have American volunteers in Colombia given the large American presence in the country. And so we always need volunteers. It's really not as, you know, wacky and crazy as you might think, but we're all very normal, boring people, and I really do think that we take a lot of care about our safety, like Sarah was saying. And we also have a similar list as you can sign up on the website, where we would ask you to call in very occasional crises to help put pressure on to keep the people that we accompany safe so that they can keep doing their work.
Another thing, just like what you were saying about the importance of having U.S. volunteers, I think that it's incredibly important for the U.S. to be involved in Colombia because... Well, it's incredible for U.S. civilians to be involved because the U.S. is already there in terms of the military aid and the actual military who are there. The U.S. is having an enormous impact on Colombia. So it's also important for us to be there as a positive force, whether that's going as part of a delegation or supporting volunteers to go or however that comes out. But I know right now all eyes are really focused on Iraq and the elections, and those things are very important, of course. And at the same time, there's a war going on in Colombia, a hidden war, really, that we don't hear much about, and yet we contribute to enormously through our tax dollars. So please get involved.
And volunteering is amazing. I had an amazing experience. Sometimes people say, you're so brave, you sacrifice, but there's no place I would rather be. And it's just, I learned so much, and so I really encourage people to do it.
Yeah, it was, I think I would say, the best year of my life. And we're both going back, so we must have really loved it.
All right, well, I want to thank you both for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We have just been talking with Sarah Weintraub. She is with the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and Eric Schwartz. He is with Peace Brigades International.